again. This is part two of Doubleheader Monday. Right now, I'm so excited that I can barely even contain myself. Visiting with me on Authors on the Air is international bestselling author James Rollins. Stick around, and you're going to hear from him directly. Be right back. On the Air, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. As I stated earlier, James Rollins is with me tonight. Boy, what a coup. As most of you know, unless you've been living under a rock, James is an international best-selling author. He's been on the New York Times bestseller list I can't tell you how many times. His Sigma series has been lauded as one of the top crowd-pleasing reads. He's been a hot summer read in People magazine, although I don't even know about that. His books are more than beach reads, that's for sure. But he's most famous for his originality in writing his storylines, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Let me welcome to the studio James Rollins. Jim, thank you so much for agreeing to be with me on Authors on the Air tonight. How are you?
I'm doing great, Pam.
Terrific. Now, you're kind of landlocked right now, so you're my captive guest, as it were, but you said that you can now leave and go home if you choose to do so, except you're writing again.
Yeah, I usually do a lot of writing up on my cabin up in the mountains, and we had a couple big snowstorms that came through and then a warm rain up here in the Sierra Nevadas. And for one moment, there was no way to leave my cabin. We had a rock slide on one way, flooded roads on the other, and pretty much I just had to hunker down. And luckily, my power stayed on for most of the time, so I didn't have to worry too much. It gave me a good excuse to do a little more research and get a few more pages written.
Wow, how fantastic. Do you typically go there to write, or do you have other areas that you like to write in?
You know, I write anywhere and at any time. I pretty much made a commitment to myself to write 5 out of 7 days of the week, 5 double-spaced pages a day. So no matter where I'm at, I first started writing during my lunch hour at the veterinary clinic I owned. And so, I was used to being interrupted by phone calls, the receptionist, dogs barking, cats meowing. So to me, I don't need a quiet space to write. I do like it up here in the mountains where it's just me and the dogs, and I have, not a lot of excuses but to write, because I can find other things to do and not write if I'm not careful. Even with my programming to write those 5 pages a day, it's still, there's other things that can draw me away from that desk if I let it.
I'm assuming you are not still practicing veterinary medicine anymore,
I always resent when someone says, I've been introduced oftentimes like former veterinarian, and I always have to correct that. No, I can still neuter a cat in under 30 seconds. Take that pride in that fact, more so than even the New York Times bestselling line above my name on my book covers is the fact that I can still do that neutering and spaying. I work with a group. I've been working with them for at this point probably about a decade after I stopped practicing full-time. And a group that traps feral cats, wild cats, they bring them to the shelter, and I volunteer my time to 8 hours one Sunday a month spaying and neutering them. So basically all I do now with my veterinary degree is just that. It's just removing genitalia.
Just PNRs. Yeah.
It's a hobby.
Well,
keeps you busy.
I'm a huge fan of rescues. I have 5 rescued cats, and all but the boy were he was neutered eventually, but the rest of them, yes, they were. They were all rescued from a feline agency. So God bless you for keeping your finger in it.
God bless you for rescuing those kids.
Oh my God, I'd take 100 if I could. I'm such a, you know, nothing by halves, Jim. It's unfortunate. A collector of books, cats, and you know other things, and it's there's never a cutoff line with me, unfortunately. Only that I'm space limited. But do you miss the practice of veterinary medicine?
I do. I mean, I always wanted to be a vet since third grade. You know, I got that assignment in third grade. I'm sure somebody gets it during their elementary school years is, you know, go home and write an essay on what you want to be when you grow up. And I remember it was a point of moral dilemma for the third grade version of myself. I remember sitting at my desk, blank sheet of paper in front of me, knowing I wanted to put veterinarian down. The only problem was I didn't know how to spell it. So I remember thinking, gosh, you know, I could policeman, fireman, fill out this essay and go out and play. But I did the one thing all third graders are rather loath to do. I got the dictionary and looked it up. That determined from third grade to be a vet. So, you know, I still love, you know, medicine, science, animals. I don't necessarily miss the business side of running a practice, but I do miss working with the animals. To me, the ideal veterinary clinic would be, you know, a big chute in the front of the veterinary hospital where someone would just clip the complaint to the animal's collar, drop them down the chute, and I would just deal with the animals.
Trying to envision, and just then I had a vision of a cow going down a chute. I'm supposing, though, that you had more of a suburban practice versus a rural practice
I did do equine also. A lot of my, I was at right at the edge of the rural community in the suburban area of Sacramento. So a lot of my, I had 23 employees at one point, and about half of them seemed to have horses, so I did a lot of equine work. Half my practice was exotic, so we did birds and reptiles. Besides the typical dogs, cats, and other such creatures.
So I understand your love of animals and your love of nature. You're obviously in a cabin in the mountains. So where did the writing come in?
Well, that is a little harder to explain because, you know, I was raised Polish Roman Catholic. So, you know, I have three brothers and three sisters, so there were seven kids. You know, to keep the Polish flag in your window, you had to have at least six kids.
Absolutely.
So my mom had a spare just in case. But yeah, to me, one of my joys of growing up was trying to spin these wild stories for my younger siblings, trying to get them to believe crazy things. You know, I call it storytelling, lying, tomatoes, tomatoes. So my goal was to terrorize brothers and sisters. If tears were involved, all the better. And so there was that part of my personality. I loved to storytell, coinciding with that was my mom was an active reader, and she didn't tell us that we had to read, but because that's what she did, that's what she loved, we ended up at, oftentimes on weekends in libraries, and so I spent many of my weekends crawling around library shelves, and I was an avid reader growing up, and that's like throwing gasoline on that twisted corner of my brain that loved to tell stories. And so there was that side of my personality that loved all that. But I never thought it was a career option to be a writer. I thought it would be really cool and be something to maybe get a short story published or heaven forbid, I could actually get a book written, walk into a bookstore and see my book on a shelf. But, you know, there was no clear career track towards that. You know, you do this, this, and this, and you can become a veterinarian. You do this, this, and this, and you can fail horribly as a writer. So, I made the more correct choice of going veterinary medicine. But I continued to read, and that desire to write was always there. And even in veterinary school, I remember at one point I was doing a midnight to 8 a.m. Overnight shift in the emergency ICU area where you're monitoring the dogs and the cats that were on IV drips and making sure they're getting the medications. And it was a winter, so there was, like, I think one patient that night. So I didn't have a whole lot to do. I remember even then I was decided, well, I'm going to write a story. So even then I was, dabbling a little bit with writing, though I never took any professional course in writing, there was that desire to do so. My formal training for writing was just reading, and every now and again I get that question asked at some book signing or maybe at a writing conference. What advice would you give to somebody that wants to be a writer? And my typical answer is, if you want to be a writer, you should be writing every day. You have to practice your craft. That's the old adage. The rule of thumb is you should expect to write 1 million words before you should expect to be published. because you have to hone that craft. But I add my own caveat to that, which is that besides writing every day, you should be reading every night. Because whatever problem you have with your writing day, whether it's, you know, how to describe a character or how to do dialogue properly, it forms a knot in your head because you were struggling with during your writing day. But when you read at night and you see how somebody has tackled that problem, because you were sort of struggling with that, it begins to untie that knot. And you sort of understand better exactly what happened. And I still do that today. I mean, I still read every night, and oftentimes I have a notebook on my bedside table, and if I come across something where I see an author doing something I haven't seen done before or some unique way in which they're handling something that I've been struggling with, I'll jot a note, and I'll try to add that tool to my own writerly toolbox. And so basically that's all I did.
Interesting.
That's how I,
so let me pull on the thread a little bit. You always were reading. I mean, your mom was an avid reader. It seems like moms more than dads are readers from most of the authors that I've interviewed. But very close in number. What do you recall what you liked to read when you were younger?
I read everything. Again, I think it probably goes back to the fact that I was oftentimes spending many hours in libraries, and I would run out of something I was reading, so I'd wander into another section of the library and encounter something else that would intrigue me. You know, my first book I read, I remember entirely, was Tarzan of the Apes, Edgar Rice Burroughs, and I remember just at the back of that book, sort of an ape-to-human dictionary at the back of the book, and I was just like, wow, I could learn to speak ape. You know, that spoke both to the veterinary side of me and to the reading side of me, and then I read Black Beauty, and then I got into the Danny Dunn mysteries, and eventually I branched into science fiction and fantasy and horror and mystery. So mostly it's genre, I have to say, more than necessarily literary fiction. But I was an equal opportunity reader when it came to whatever genre that I was reading.
Interesting, because that's kind of dictated how you write now. I want to say you're a thriller writer, but that's not necessarily true, because you use a lot of science in your books. You use a lot of historical information in your books. So I'm not really sure. I just know you write really good fiction, and my eyeballs are glued to it all the time.
That is a challenge. Sometimes I have a hard time defining whether do I write historical thrillers, do I write scientific thrillers, what exactly do I write. I remember after writing, I think, about 7 or 8 books for HarperCollins, for William Morrow, which is a division of HarperCollins, I was invited for the first time to New York to meet with the publishing group. And so I remember going to this big boardroom, and one side is the marketing team, the other side is the sales team, and over here is the paperback marketers, and over here is the editor staff. And at the end of the table is the head of William Morrow, and he stands up and says, "Hey, Jim, we published 8 of your books, and at this point, we just have one question." I said, "Well, what is it?" He says, "We're not quite sure
what the hell are you?"
Can you tell us what you're writing?
Of course. Right. Well, that makes sense.
Published
by
my
understand
books,
that.
That's what I write. So, yes, I mean, I have a tendency to write a bit of a melting pot of different genres. There's mystery, there's a little bit of edge of science fiction in there, there's a bit of fantasy because I'm going to take you somewhere pretty wild, but grounded in reality with the typical sort of Clive Cussler-esque action adventure, and a little bit of Michael Crichton in there with the science. So pretty much, always tell, one of the, again, adages of writing is you should write what you love to read, and which was a challenge for me, since I'd like to read a bunch of different genres. I ended up writing books that were sort of a mishmash of a bunch of different genres.
Well, you sure did. And you also wrote a book with a couple of them, actually, with one of my other favorite writers, with Grant Blackwood. Which is interesting to me because he writes books with other people and for estates of other people, as well as his own. He's a very talented man as well. So let's talk about this whole writing thing that you've doing. When you wrote your first book, not your first published book, but your first book was your first published book. I don't know.
It was.
Okay. So let's talk about that. Which book was that, Jim?
That was Subterranean. Which, to summarize it in a nutshell, My outline for that book was I was going to take 5 characters, drop them 2 miles beneath the continent of Antarctica, throw in some monsters, and shake. You know, based on that detailed outline, I began writing that book.
And so your book sold the first time out. I it's a stunning thing because that never happens to anybody else.
It sounds easy, but it was not. At first, I wrote short fiction because that's all I thought I could fit into my veterinary clinic life.
Your
I
day.
Thought I could only write a fraction
sure.
of time, so therefore all I could probably fit is short stories. So I wrote short stories for about 3 or 4 years, and not a single one got published. And I was quite the diligent submitter. I mean, I had every type of magazine that might possibly accept that type of. Again, I wrote different genres. I was writing mysteries. I was writing fantasy. I was writing science fiction. And submitting it to all these different magazines. Not one nibble. But I got one note from a fantasy magazine called Realms of Fantasy. The editor at that time was Marion Zimmer Bradley before she passed away. And she was kind enough to send me a handwritten response back, which is always encouraged. Usually you get this form rejection letter. So to get something personally handwritten from Marion Zimmer Bradley, who's one of my heroes, she wrote The Mists of Avalon and a whole slew of sci-fi fantasy sort of mishmash books to herself. And so she wrote me a note, said, "Hey, Jim, I see that you can write. I see that, your prose is strong and you have the ability to be a writer, but I don't think you're a short story writer. I think you're innately a novelist." Now, I could have taken that one of two ways. I could have assumed that maybe she's subtly telling me, "You can't write, don't submit to us again," and this is a kind way of rejecting me. Or maybe she's
right.
Of course, I'm going to assume maybe she's right. And I realized that actually I prefer to read novels. I'm not a big short story reader. I prefer novels. If the longer the novel, the better. If they're a multi-volume series, even better. So my brain is sort of wired for a long-format storytelling. And so I took her at a word and decided, "You're right, I'm writing short stories when I'm not particularly enamored of short stories." So I stopped and wrote my first novel. It took me 11 months. I made sort of a personal commitment at that time to write 3 double-spaced pages five out of 7 days of the week. And after 11 months, I ended up having some training on my desk and started submitting it. And I was rejected by 49 different agents for that book. It was the 50th agent. I'm not even rounding up or rounding down. It was 50, the 50th agent. Saw something in that rough draft of Subterranean and accepted it. And she began submitting it and got a lot of rejections initially. But eventually there were 2 publishing houses that did a little bidding war for the book. And I ended up getting the book sold.
It's amazing that those things happen and they don't anymore, or rarely, I should say. It used to be the norm when someone was publishing, before independent publishing and self-publishing and small press and all. I know that there used to be bidding wars on books, and I think maybe there are still, but we just don't hear about it. I mean, PW is certainly not telling anyone. I think they don't want to encourage anyone to think that that's going to be the norm. Were you stunned?
Oh,
or
definitely. I thought she was crazy, the agent that accepted the novel. Because after 49 different, and the rejections weren't necessarily kind. I mean, they're again usually the form rejection letter, but I got one rejection from I still have it from the St. Martin's Press editor. I submitted directly to the publishing house with that submission, and he was kind enough to send me the form rejection letter. "Dear sir or ma'am, we hate your book. Don't submit to again, editor." But he was kind enough, again, similar to Marion Zimmer Bradley, to write me a personal note. And the note was just 3 words: "This is unpublishable." So I thought, it was kind of him reject me, but take the extra special time to kick me in the nuts besides. I was pretty much, after 49 different rejections, I was like, is this woman, is she scamming me? Is she going to ask me for money? So I was just
skeptical. I hope you saved her letter, by the way.
Pardon me?
I hope you saved her letter to you, her note
to
you.
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
Oh, I still have it.
Interesting. So Subterranean is published, and by the way, I'm looking at the numbers for Subterranean. It was a huge seller. I mean, you did really, really well with this book. And, I'm looking at your reviews on it. People love the book. I mean, you were a hit.
I have to say that a lot of that success was because of Avon at that point. It was the one that picked up the book, which eventually got assumed by HarperCollins too. But they were very supportive of the series. I find out afterwards that the head honcho at that point was looking for somebody that they could groom, similar to Michael Crichton, somebody that maybe was writing, you know, sort of a science-based story, but based in real time and place, that they could maybe spin off on that. So I just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And this is the odd thing. I've written 33 books at this point. The Seventh Plague, my current book, is my 33rd book. And I've had the same editor since the beginning of my career, which is unheard of in the publishing industry.
It's unheard of. Yeah.
So Lissa, the editor that did a bidding war once upon a time with my agent for Subterranean, is the editor that edited Seventh Plague. So it's nice having that relationship from the beginning to now with the same editor. She's great. I trust her. No matter what she says, I know there's a reason she's saying it, and so I really respect her. And
that's fabulous.
It's great having that relationship, which is rare in this field.
It's rare to still be with the same publishing house too. You know, so but to have your editor going, you know, along with you is wonderful. When you look back on Subterranean and then you look at Seventh Plague, which is out now, what do you notice about your writing style?
Well, I hope it's gotten better. I mean, again, similar to what I mentioned before is, you know, I'm always sort of self-educating myself. You know, I always think I could do better, and I challenge myself, and I read. I find those other tools that other writers are using and try to utilize them. But fundamentally, I think if you read Subterranean, you read The Seventh Plague, you would know it was the same writer that wrote those two, because, you know, fundamentally, I write these big, gigantic, you know, action-adventure with
you write epic books.
And
I
epic
like
stories
to think of them as
with
epic.
A lot of science.
Yeah.
Pick a science topic, and I'm going to take it to the edge of the horizon, maybe peek beyond that to see where maybe that science is headed, try to answer that historical mystery. So the fundamentals of what I write are from Subterranean until today are still there. I hope that, you know, I've gotten better in regards to being able to tell a story.
Well, do you think you have? Do you look at your work and cringe from the past, or do you, you know, do you look at it still with kind of pride and
I
say,
do,
"Oh,
I
this
can't,
is really
I have
not
to admit
too
that
bad."
I have picked up some of my earlier books and go, "Ooh, I wish I could rewrite this scene or that piece of dialogue. I have a better line." It's like, you know, you always have that comeback where somebody says something to you and you sort of stumble for a response, but then like an hour later you find that perfect response and you go, "Oh, I wish I had said that." So a lot of times I'll read my book in the past and go, "Oh, I wish I had done that." So it's but eventually you have to let that baby go. You know, pretty much I always, you know, tell people that I'm teaching how to write or whatever, that just write your book to the best of your ability today and submit it. And then don't keep, which is a trap I think a lot of writers fall into, especially first-time writers, is they will keep churning the same novel. They will keep rewriting and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting that same book.
Right.
And it's
right.
hard. Once you've written a story, it becomes a little bit set in concrete, and no matter what revision is necessarily going to get better. The only way you're going to get better as a writer, let that book go, write your next book. And so, though I might have some regrets, I wish I could do some twists and turns. You know, I still love Subterranean. I've just read that maybe about 7-8 months ago, and I'm thinking of maybe writing a sequel to that. So I just figured I'd go ahead and reread that book, and I still enjoyed it. I still appreciate a lot of the things I did write in that book, and I think it is a rollicking adventure.
It stands the test of time for you.
At least for me. So I still get a lot.
How many books a year do you write, Jim? How many books a year do you write? Two books.
I do two a year.
You've
done that pretty much.
Your books are very research intensive, though, aren't they?
They are. And generally, when I say two books a year, I'll do one Sigma book a year, which is what I call the big book of the year. And then the other half of the year, I'll do something else. I'll dabble with another standalone. I'll try a different genre, whether it's like a vampire series that I wrote with Rebecca, whether it's another something totally off genre. So I use the other book of that year just to try to keep myself fresh, is not to write the same thing over and over again. If I did that, I think I would get a little bit bored, and I've sort of experienced that from reading other writers, where maybe after a while you can sort of sense that they're bored with their story. I think readers have a good nose for when a writer's getting bored with their own work or feeling a little stale with their work. And so I think one of the ways it helps me stay fresh with my big, long Sigma series, which is the Seventh Plague is the 12th book in that series, is by doing something mm-hmm. else the other part of the year, is stretch my literary legs a little bit and do something different so that I'm not feeling like I'm writing the same thing over and over and over again.
Hmm. Interesting to me. You said that you can pretty much, you don't mind the noise, but you don't mind the quiet when you're writing. Do you have a preference, though? Are you a guy who would go and sit in a coffee shop and write books?
No, simply because I'm not that comfortable. Actually, where I think I found myself the most content writing is on an airplane. I don't know what it is. I don't know.
Really?
You know, I'll put my noise-canceling headphones on, but just for some reason, I'm very productive when I'm on an airplane. I don't know why.
It's interesting. How extensively do you outline?
Not as much as you might suspect if you read one of my novels. My novels are, you know, they're a big roller coaster of an adventure,
yes.
But I don't necessarily put every twist and turn. I don't necessarily plot that up beforehand. I do know the beginning. I know the end. Oftentimes I know my last line before I write my first line. And I know a few of the stopping points in between. These are basically three or four action set piece tent poles that are going to be part of that story. But don't necessarily know how A connects to B connects to C, because to me one of the joys of writing is that discovery as I'm between mm-hmm. those gaps and working towards that story. If I know the story to a T, I don't know if I'd be as excited writing it.
Interesting. You have some series that you write, some series characters. Do we know everything we're going to know about them, or are you still discovering something about your characters?
With my plots, I have arcs for all the major characters in the Sigma universe. I sort of know where they're going to be ending up. I shouldn't mm-hmm. say ending, but they're ending up. And, some will be ending. But I know their arcs in general terms, but I do discover new things about them, as mostly when I'm interacting with new characters that are maybe in one of the installments of the Sigma series, they'll interact with somebody new, mm-hmm. and because of the interaction, I'll discover new things about the character that I've been writing for, you know, 7, 8, 9 books. So that's sort of fun to do too, is to see how these characters have evolved. Also, my universe is not static. You know, we're seeing these characters grow. We're seeing them get married. We're seeing them have kids. We're seeing them trying to juggle their professional, personal lives. And that dynamic of character that I also think attracts people to the series is mm-hmm. people are, it's like I am, I'm attached to this character. I would swear I can walk around the corner and see, you know, Commander Grayson Pierce at some point down my hall. But I've been immersed with these characters now for 12 books, 12 big books, so basically over 12 years, so they're a big part of my life, but I'm still learning new things about them.
Interesting. Is it safe to say that one of the most difficult things that you would ever have to do is kill off a major character? And could you do that?
I can do that, and I have done that.
How has your fan base reacted to that?
They've been shocked. I tested the waters initially at one book where I sort of looked like I killed off one of the main characters of Sigma, and the reaction mm-hmm. was quite vehement, to put it mildly, about the fate of that character. While at the same time, if you read closely, there were seeds in that story that indicated that the character was still alive, and in the next book, you do, lo and behold, the character is still alive. But then further down the series, I have killed off some major characters in that universe. And again, I don't do it gratuitously. I don't do it just for the shock value, which sometimes I'm watching television shows or other books where it feels like the death is more for shock value than truly part of the story. So I try to make the deaths not gratuitous or just for pure shock value. There's, you know, it makes sense to the story that this is where this has happened. And so I don't have much difficulty with doing that because it feels right. And then I do
gotta change it up, don't you?
Worried about how people are going to react because sometimes people have been shocked.
Yeah, you have to change it up, though. I mean, I would imagine just for the sake of the story or a series, you have to do something major. You've got to throw a stick in the spokes to throw the character off, the story off anyway. Let me ask you something.
Yeah, all my earliest books were standalones. And I resisted doing a series for a while. I was getting a lot of pressure from Harper to do a series because series are easier for them to sell. But fundamentally, I like doing standalone stories. And I also had a concern about series, what I call the Jessica Fletcher syndrome from, Jessica Fletcher from Murder, She Wrote. Here's a woman that was stumbling over dead bodies every week. And, I've never stumbled over a dead body, so why is this woman stumbling over dead bodies? So after a while, it strains your sense of credibility that this is happening to this woman. But also there's the concern when you have a serious character about Jeopardy is that, again, let's say somebody holds a gun against Jessica Fletcher's head in an episode. You know that gun is never going to be shot because she's in next week's episode. So it's hard to maintain that Jeopardy. So I've resisted that doing the series until I wrote Sandstorm, and that's where Sigma Force is first introduced. I was not planning on doing the series when I wrote Sandstorm. Sigma Force isn't even the main characters in that novel. There's a different set of characters that are the main heroes and heroines of that story. Sigma is more a sort of support to that storyline. But I like that group, these sort of scientists with guns, these ex-Special Forces soldiers that have been recruited by DARPA to be field agents. And I thought, well, what if I base this series on a group rather than one character? And then so that got me around a lot of my concerns about the series because, the Jeopardy can come from very many different directions. Nobody's safe. I can kill off major characters because Sigma can always recruit new ones. It allows me in different books to shine the spotlight on different members of the books.
You have an ensemble cast that you're working with, so
exactly.
It gives you a little bit more freedom. Yeah.
That's where I discover new things with characters, too, is that I can shift that spotlight to concentrate on one character in the Sigma universe, and the next book switch that spotlight onto a different character. So it allows me to, slowly start like an onion, I'm peeling an onion. We see, more and more layers of these different characters that spotlight gets switched around.
When you are sitting down to write a new book, do you have the story in your head first, or do you have the character?
When it comes to
particularly with standalones,
again,
I think
it comes from many different directions. I wish I had a concrete way of saying, I do this, this, and this, and here's my story. Because the story comes from sometimes many different directions. Sometimes it is, like my novel Amazonia, I had taken a trip to the Amazon. I just wanted to write a story in the Amazon. So it was setting that became the seed for that story. Sometimes it's the history. When I wrote Devil Colony, which deals with the fact that the Native Americans during the colonial time contributed a lot to our founding documents. That little interesting historical tidbit became the jumping-off point for that story. Other times it's the science that intrigues me that starts the story. So it varies. I wish I could say, I've written an entire different series where it was the character. I had this idea for this basically this young girl that develops his magical powers that, again, it was usually, back when I was writing this, it was always like the young farm boy who finds the magic sword or the magic ring or the magic
book. Right.
And so I thought, what if it was a girl that is the one that's imbued, that finds that special innate ability of hers, and what if in that world, magic was forbidden to women? And so it was that type of dynamic that became that series.
Interesting. I'm fascinated by the way you jump around, seemingly jump around, but really I'm sure it's more controlled than it sounds like. You really do pick these random topics and kind of subgenres to go to. Do you ever want to write just strictly in one genre? Is there something you haven't tried that you want to do? Because you've really kind of, it's like we said earlier, it's hard to define where to, if they had subgenres on the bookshelves, it'd be hard to nowhere to place you. You'd be all over a bookstore rather than just in fiction. So is there something you want to try that you haven't
written? I've tried going straight into certain genres. I mean, my sigma novels are definitely sort of this amalgam of different genres. But, I have written straight high fantasy series. I have written with Rebecca sort of a horror series.
Yeah.
Sort of romantic horror, a little bit of romance, a little bit of horror. I've written a middle school series that is basically just, again, sort of going back to what I loved to read as a kid, Alfred Hitchcock 3 investigator series, these Danny Dunn scientific thrillers, where it was basically an ordinary kid, a kid that didn't have magical powers, that was pulled into a great adventure. So that was my middle school series. So, I have definitely dabbled with one genre that I've never strictly gone for the pure genre is which I'd love to do, is mystery. So I'd love to actually maybe at one point do a pure mystery story.
Interesting. And yet, I still think your books are mysteries, to a greater or lesser degree. If I had they're thrillers to me. They just have a different bent to them. It's the Rollins subgenre is what it is. I guess that's the only way we're going to be able to explain it. It's genre defying. Okay. I want to take a moment just
novels where I can have my own section of a bookstore.
Well, you're in every section of the bookstore, so good for you. I want to remind everyone that you're listening to Authors on the Air. My special guest tonight is James Rollins. We're talking about his undefinable but absolutely wonderful books. We're not sure where to put him in the bookstore, so you'll have to just look up and down every row, maybe even in cooking and self-help. I don't know. If you want to call in and say hi to Jim, please do. The number is 347-633-9609. I want to remind everyone that on Wednesday, I am not taking the microphone, but instead, two of Ocean View Publishing's finest will be here. Matt Coyle is taking the reins from me and is going to interview Dave Putnam, which should be an interesting evening. I hope you join me at 9 o'clock. The number again to talk to Jim Rollins is 347-633-9609. Jim, you seem to be living the writer's life. You still dabble in your first chosen profession of veterinary medicine, and you're having fun writing all these wonderful books and being very successful and critically acclaimed at it. Is there something else you want to do that has nothing to do with writing or veterinary medicine?
Gosh, that's a good question. Probably one of the things I would love to do is go on an archaeological. I don't think I want to be an archaeologist, but I'd love to go on an archaeological dig, because that was probably the other thing beyond veterinary medicine that was on my list of my third grade version of myself, and you probably could guess that from the type of books that I write always have an archaeological bent to them. I think I would love to be sort of an assistant on an archaeological dig somewhere deep in a jungle.
It would be interesting.
Deep in the desert. That'd be fun.
And it seems to suit you. I'm not surprised that you're saying that. You said that you write you write every morning and you read every night. Whose book are you reading right now?
I am reading Prince Lestat and the Realms of Atlantis. I think that's the title. It's a long time. But Anne Rice's latest book in her vampire series.
That is
what is on my...
Is there something that you don't like to read, by the way?
I'm not a big literary reader, though I do try to read, the National Book Award every year, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book every year.
Right.
But it is, to be honest, a little bit of an arm-twisting... gritting my
experience. I can relate. I'm a genre fiction girl myself, so I understand that. All kudos to those people who can. I have a friend who's a reviewer for the Miami Herald. She reads a lot of literary fiction, and God bless her, she's way smarter than I am, but it is not exciting enough for me. I know that sounds horrible. It should pull the emotional and the intellectual side, but give me the thrill ride anytime and I'm happy. So I understand that completely. I'm there with you. What kind of music do you like to listen to?
Mostly 80s rock and roll, big Bruce Springsteen fan. I remember going to, on the night before I took my veterinary boards, I went, ended up, rather than studying, I went to a Bruce Springsteen concert. It was up till 2 o'clock in the morning, rocking out to Bruce Springsteen.
Of course you did.
I had to be up at 7 o'clock to take my veterinary boards.
But you passed, obviously, so good for you. Do you have any other creative pursuits other than writing that you enjoy?
You know, I would love to be able to draw. You know, I was an avid comic book reader too growing up, and so I remember, trying to draw. It's a talent I do not have. I tried. I wish I could be a better artist in that regard. If you read any of my books,
uh-huh.
You probably can guess I have a little bit of a stymied artistic thing, because there's a lot of illustrations that I do myself that are in the book.
Yes.
So that, again, is a part of me that I think goes back to that side of me that would like to do some type of drawing, but I don't have the talent for it. I could, it takes me just to do one little piece of art that appears in one of my books. That probably takes me 4 or 5 days. So, something that takes up one quarter of a page could take me days
and
days.
Interesting. That's funny. I know you travel quite a bit. Do you travel for fun and discover things that you want to write about, or do you travel to discover things you want to write about and have fun?
I travel for the fun of it. I think I could probably count on like one hand the number of times I've actually purposely traveled for research. It's very seldom I'm going to set a story in Paris, fly to Paris, run around Paris, come back and write about it. What I usually do is I'll just travel, and I take a bunch of pictures. I journal when I travel, so I try to, get some type of, flavor captured on paper. I'll be in a small village. I'm notorious walking up to some, stranger in a town or village, say, hey, tell me something about this place that nobody knows about. Tell me a secret that nobody knows about this place. And oftentimes that becomes a seed for a story. They'll tell me things that I was never aware of. And it'll just end up, put all my notes and my pictures together in a little folder, and it'll end up on my shelf. And whenever my characters happen to be going, close to that area, I'll sort of guide them there because I've already have my ready-made research already done from that previous travels. Like in Seven of the Plague, a lot of it takes place in Egypt, and this goes back 5 or 6 years ago when I was in Egypt. I attended a lecture by an archaeologist there. He proposed this different theory for explaining how the Book of Exodus could actually be a historical event, not just mythology. It was really intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
Made my notes, put it on a shelf. 5 years later, the Seventh Plague.
There you go.
A lot of information from the lecture series.
So you've just intrigued me by what you say to the village people. So here's my question to you. What is something someone we would be surprised to learn about you? Tell me something nobody knows about you.
Oh. Once upon a time, I used to be a young ventriloquist.
Really?
The other V I wanted to have my veterinary medicine was going to be vet ventriloquist. Yep, I had a Charlie McCarthy doll, learned to throw my voice, and I don't think I'd be very good at it today, but once upon a time I was fairly good at it. The nerdy stuff.
Where were you born? Where were you born?
Chicago, Illinois.
Yeah, you have a very Midwestern accent still. interesting. I went to a conference there in February, which is the worst thing you could ever do is go to Chicago in February.
I'll never go back.
God, I'll never go back. I went to a Love is Murder conference there. I thought, of course Love is Murder. You're going to die because it's so damn cold there. It was miserable.
Yep,
I couldn't believe it.
I've been to that conference. I did that
horrible.
Winter Love is Murder conference.
What a horrible thing to do to anyone is tell someone who's born and raised in Miami to come to Chicago in February. It's a cruel thing they did to me. I'll never do that again. you have dogs, I know. We talked about that before the show. What are your pets' names?
Duncan and Echo. I had Penny,
Duncan
but she passed
Echo.
Away 12 months ago. So I'm down to two dogs now.
Okay. How do you name your characters?
Sometimes it's just I I can come to it really fast. And usually when I come to a name really fast, I'm very satisfied with that name. Sometimes it has to do a little bit with the character, like Commander Grayson Pierce. His name is Gray, and you know, that name is chosen because, you know, he is sort of really good at using both sides of his brain. You know, he's got a very scientific side, but also he's a very artistic side.
Interesting.
He's able to solve puzzles because of this ability to sort of deal with the two sides of his brain. So he's sort of a mixture, black and white, so he becomes gray. So it's
interesting.
But other times, you know, to be honest, sometimes it's people that I know, to be honest with you. A lot of people say, hey, Jim, you know, why don't you put me in one of your books? And I say, okay, I can, but if I do, I'm going to kill you in a horrible, horrible way.
Stab you in the eye with a long dagger or something. But
some
sure,
people,
we'll put you in there. Why not? Sure.
If the people that mostly die horribly, horribly in my book, they're usually people I know.
There you go. Gosh. Don't write me in your book, Jim. That is so funny. Tell everybody where we can find you on the webs, please.
Well, I've got my sort of my encyclopedia is my website. So if you want to sort of get a full spectrum of the books and bios and interviews, and there's a section in there about, you know, my tips on how to write. That's, you know, jamesrollins.com. But probably I'm more active on Facebook and Twitter if you want to have that more intimate connection, which I really enjoy. And once upon a time when I first started, back when Subterranean first sold, you know, very few authors even had websites. You know, the internet was something new and exciting. I remember when Facebook first came out, I talked to HarperCollins. I said, hey, you know, this Facebook is intriguing. I think it's a way I can communicate with my authors, I mean, my readers. And they were like, don't bother. That's a waste of time. You know, now, of course,
right.
HarperCollins has classes.
They won't even talk to you if you don't have social media.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's funny.
So it's different
that's
worlds.
Funny.
So
wow.
That's where I'm at.
What is do you have a title for the book you're working on now? And if you do, are you free to share it?
I am, because I generally don't if I'm really close to being done the book. And the book that's coming out next is called The Demon Crown. It's another Sigma Force novel.
Are you enjoying writing this series, obviously?
I have a lot to say about it.
Yeah,
I do also, like I said, I think what keeps me fresh with the series is that I do something else with the other part of the year. So it's nice to do something different and then come back to those characters. It's, you know, like, then I miss them. You know, after writing, you know, half a year plus research, you know, on some Sigma book, you know, it's I can see easily if I had to turn around and revisit those characters immediately again, I could see doing 12, 13 books in that type of order. It might burn me out a little bit, but by, you know, taking a little vacation from them, then I grow to miss them, and I'm ready to jump into another one of their books.
You're ready to jump into it. I have one last question, and then I'm going to let you go because I've kept you longer than I told you I would, and thank you for your patience. What is the criteria for you to co-author a book with someone?
You know, again, that was one of the other books. You know, when my first co-authoring was not with Grant, it was with Rebecca Cantrell.
Right.
And
Becky's great.
You know,
she's been a guest.
I had this idea for this vampire series. It was very different. I'm not going to go into in length exactly how that vampire series came about. It's, again, it's a bit of a mix of a genre. It's got a lot of history. It's got a lot of science. It's a very different take on vampirism. And but it didn't really fit my wheelhouse of what I normally write. And I knew when I had this big, gigantic world that sort of kept sort of snowballing in my head, and when that happens, it's hard for me to let go. I have to do something with it. But I knew that story needed to be more gothic in nature, less this just sort of the staccato-paced thriller that I write. You know, so I knew Rebecca. She actually took one of my writing classes before she was ever published, and so I really respected her even in that class. I could tell she was going to be a successful writer. I gave her one of her first blurbs on her first books, and you know, her books, as you probably know from interviewing her before, are a mystery set between World War I and World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What I was really impressed with her was that, you know, with a few, you know, strokes of her pen, she's able to create these very evocative, you know, characters and senses of place. And I thought, gosh, you know, that's almost what this book needs. And I was reading one of her latest Hannah Vogel mysteries, and I thought, gosh, this is just what I was, you know, would really fit well with what I want with the series I was had in my head. So So I called Rebecca and said, "Hey, Rebecca, I have this, you know, the story idea, and you know, it's not necessarily my wheelhouse, but maybe, you know, I could bring the science and the mystery and the weird animals, but you know, maybe if you could bring that gothic touch that you have with your writing, and you know, maybe we can work on a series together." And she goes, "Well, what's it about?" And I go, "Well, it's about vampires." And she goes, "No, I have no idea, no desire to write anything about vampires." And I go, "Well, just let me explain what
God
I'm talking about."
Becca.
So I laid the whole history out, and the more I was, you know, I knew I had her hooked because after a while she started asking me questions, and by the time the conversation was over, she said, "Yes, that sounds fantastic. I would love to write that." And so then neither of us had collaborated before, so it was a learning curve on how to do that exactly. You know, first what we ended up doing was, you know, working out the outline together and then divvying up who was going to handle which writing assignments first. We'd Skype just for 6 to 8 hours so we can visually see each other, because at that point she was living in Hawaii. Eventually she ended up moving to Berlin. Now she's back in Hawaii. And so,
the woman travels, that's for sure. I know.
She does.
Good grief.
And so initially we were sort of treating each other with kids' gloves. You know, it's like, you know, Rebecca, I see what you did with this scene, but, you know, maybe if you just tweak this over here. But eventually we got to the point where it's like, Jim, this scene sucks, rewrite it. So once we got to that point, production became much faster.
That's funny.
So
there you go.
I don't
when
that,
you
I
stop
to
trying
to
when you stop trying to be PC,
Exactly. So I'd only work with somebody that I know well. I knew Rebecca for years. Grant, I've known from years. We pretty much rose through our sort of our career simultaneously. I knew, you know, Grant was with the International Thriller Writers in the
right.
In on the board with me, so I knew Grant from the beginning. And so I created Tucker and Kane, this Army Ranger and his military war dog, for my book Bloodline, for my Sigma book Bloodline. And I always thought, you know, it'd be fun to spin them off. I remember, like, over drinks at Thriller Fest, I was whining to him about how I would like to be able to spin these characters into their own solo series. And he goes, "Oh, I love those characters too. You know, if you want, I'd love to work with those together with you." And I thought, "That's great. Let's do that." So again, it has to be that personal relationship, I think, for me to kind of collaborate.
It's interesting to me as a non-writer, but an observer of all of you writers. How much business transpires in the bar at a conference. It never fails to amaze me, no matter which conference I'm at, if there are two writers in a bar, it doesn't matter. There could be 200 or 2,000, but if there are two writers in a bar, there's going to be some collaboration happening there. It doesn't matter the conference.
A solitary profession. You know, we're always locked in our offices by ourselves. No one understands really what
we're doing.
So when we get to a bar and there's somebody somebody's let us loose from our leashes, so we can run around for a little bit, and then you run into another like-minded character that is in the trenches, similar trenches. It's always fun to commiserate.
It's an amazing. I will tell you what happened. I was at VoucherCon in North Carolina, I think, and of course, you know, after all the panels are out, everybody immediately heads to the bar, and the cacophony in the bar is just amazing. The sound, and it carries throughout every lobby and every hotel. I don't care where you are. I don't care how well built or how small the place is. It doesn't matter. So I was walking in to meet friends, and the manager of the bar was standing a few steps above where the crowd was gathered, and he had a big grin on his face, and I looked at him and I said, "What are you smiling about?" And he said, "Did you know that these people are all writers?" And I said, "Yeah, I did." And he said, "I thought they were quiet." And I just had to laugh. And I said, "Well, this is what happens when you let writers out of their cave." And I said, they see each other. They're a collegiate group. You know, they love to talk. They love to socialize. And I said, it's the most supportive group of individuals you'll ever meet. He said, "They all know each other." And I said, "No, they don't." I said, "That's just the way they are. They don't know.
Yep.
They don't know each other. Most of them have never met before. So it doesn't matter. They're old friends because they're all like-minded." It was truly the look on his face was sheer amazement. He thought he'd never see. You would have thought it was Shriners, coming in from the parade or something. But
It has been a pleasure speaking to you, Jim Rollins. I wish you continued success. Obviously, you're just doing great. Breaking records, you know, people are loving your books. I hope it continues for a long time for you. And don't practice the ventriloquist act anymore. You don't need to. You're just
okay.
I think you found your spot, right? Much success to you. I think you have. I hope that we bump into each other at a con one day. It'd be fun to say hello in person. And I thank you again so much for being my guest tonight. Have a terrific evening. Be careful up there in the mountains. And thank you so much.
Thanks, Pam.
Good night.
Good night.
And that's my show for tonight, folks. What a terrific guy. Don't forget, Wednesday night, Matt Coyle takes the microphone and interviews Dave Putnam. That's going to be fun. Thanks for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.